You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Jeffrey Burke about thoroughbred sales work for yearlings, two-year-olds, and young track horses. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Burke began his veterinary career as a racetrack practitioner and subsequently started a practice in Ocala, Florida. A past president of the AAEP in 2019, he also served on the AAEP's Executive Committee as Treasurer and AAEP Foundation Advisory Council as Chair. Previously, he served as a Director-at-Large on the AAEP Board and recently as Chair of AAEP's Racing Committee and Nominating Committee. A graduate of University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Burke is currently residing and practicing in Lexington, Kentucky with Equine Medical Associates. His primary practice focus is international thoroughbred sales work. His horse ownership has included the purchasing, breeding, selling, and racing of thoroughbreds. Thank you, Dr. Burke, for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. Can you walk us a little bit through your background and how you got into thoroughbred sales work?
Sure. Well, just generally in terms of getting involved with animals, my father is a veterinarian, and he was a large animal vet when I was growing up in Connecticut. So I got exposed to all kinds of animals. And when I went to veterinary school at Penn, I used to go down to Delaware Park in the summertime and be a hot walker and a groom at the racetrack. And so I kind of just got addicted to the whole racehorse thing at that point. And so that I knew that was going to be my path. When I graduated from Penn, I went to Thistledown Racetrack as a racetrack practitioner and worked there, got good racetrack experience, and then moved to Ocala to start my own practice and had a general practice, but quite a bit of off-track training was a great part of it. In 2010, I was actually diagnosed as having a tumor on my spinal cord. So I decided to basically make a change and not do overall complete thoroughbred practice anymore. I've just focused on thoroughbred sales work, moved to Lexington. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So I think if there's any significance in all of that, it's probably that, you know, since today's discussion is relative to primarily sales work, I think that it's not something that you just jump into. It's not like a subspecialty that you learn in veterinary school. I think it takes a lot of time looking at lame horses, blocking lame horses, doing the diagnostics to learn over time what will significantly affect the soundness of an individual horse as opposed to things that aren't that important.
Yeah, it sounds like your experience with all types of thoroughbreds at different stages of their lives probably really informs what you do with sales work and younger horses today.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about what thoroughbred sales work entails? Are you primarily working at private sales or auctions? And at what point of the sales process are you involved?
It's primarily auctions. There is a significant amount of private sales that go on as well. So I'm doing mostly auctions, and that calendar is pretty steady throughout the year, and it's obviously determined by the sales companies and based upon the ages of the horse. So starting in January, we've got some mixed sales, and then we get into the two-year-old and training season, what they call in Europe the breeze-up sales, and those take place primarily in Florida through the OBS sales company, although Basic Tipton does have a Maryland sale in May. So that comprises the sales season in the springtime. When we get into summer, we start with the yearlings at Basic Tipton in Kentucky in July, then Saratoga, and then, of course, the Keeneland September, Basic Tipton October sales. These are all yearling sales. And then there's a scattering of the same type of sale, yearlings in Europe that I attend as well. And so once we get through the end of October and get into November, we start getting into breeding stock sales, and that will carry on through into December. The last thoroughbred sale of the year is the the Arcana sale. The Arcana Sales Company conducts a sale in Deauville, France, usually the first week in December. And then the rest of December is quiet. And then we start all over again in January. So that's pretty much how it works. And I work most of the American sales. And then I fit in all of the European sales in between when I can.
Now, are you working for the trucks or the sellers or the buyers? Like, who do you represent at these sales?
Primarily buyers. I do have a couple of clients here in Lexington that I work for on a sort of a consulting basis for their sales work for them as sellers. But my primary work is for buyers.
Okay, great. So I guess moving now into more of the physical examination part of this, what are some of the main components of your exam and how does this approach differ when you're evaluating yearlings versus two-year-olds or three-year-olds?
Sure. Well, first of all, basically how it works is that obviously the clients, the buying clients are examining horses, looking at horses to see which ones would interest them. And when they narrow that list down to what we call the short list, which is basically the final list of horses that they're interested in, they give me the short list, and then I'm asked to do my job, which is basically the job that I do is basically three things at sales. We're doing a good thorough physical exam. We are also evaluating the upper airway, and that can be done either by us scoping the horses ourselves as veterinarians, or now there are in many sales a video of the throat. Video scope is provided, and it's part of the material that's provided for us in the repository. And then the third thing would be the evaluation of the x-rays. So those three things pretty much comprise what goes on at a public auction from a veterinary standpoint.
And what are some common findings that you see in these horses? I imagine that it probably differs a little bit between unstarted and started horses, but are there any common musculoskeletal or soft tissue or respiratory things that come up fairly frequently?
Well, just as you said, it really does kind of depend on the age of the horse. You know, typically, if we're looking at weanlings at a breeding stock sale, you're looking for developmental abnormalities, various things like OCD lesions. Of course, there are fragments in joints sometimes, things like that. Those things are not necessarily going to be a problem for the horse, but, you know, we're evaluating the horse in terms of what may be a problem from a performance standpoint, but also what may affect the value of the horse. So we're doing two things for the client. We're basically trying to assess the level of risk with regard to any soundness issues. And then on top of that, anything that we do find may or may not be important, but may affect the saleability of the horse. So in older horses, obviously, especially horses of racing age, those are probably the most challenging horses to vet because they've been racing. Horses, just like humans, typically sustain injuries along the way during an athletic career. Some of them are minor, some are not so minor, and it's our job to try to find those things and then place a level of risk on them.
Right. So I'm a little bit less familiar with how exams work in the auction setting, but do you have the same bandwidth to like get hands on the horse and do imaging and flexions as you might if you were doing a pre-purchase on a farm, or are you a little bit more constrained in that setting?
I think we are more constrained for several reasons. I mean, if I go do a purchase exam on one horse and I'm traveling to wherever the horse is located, not only do I have the time, but basically the license to go through the motions. It's relatively private. There's not a lot of people around. I think, you know, when you think about it from the consigner standpoint, they're bringing horses to the sale. They might have a consignment of 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 horses, and there's a lot of traffic there, and there's not really the opportunity to be flexing and jogging horses and things like that. Now, obviously, in horses of racing age, you know, we do jog them and we go over them carefully, but the time frame is compressed. And especially in horses that have not yet entered training, the perception is that they're much less likely to have sustained a serious injury. So, yeah, to answer your question, it's just a different setting and it has its own rules as far as what you can do and how much time you have to do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. This episode of Disease du Jour is sponsored by Equithrive. Brought to you by Equithrive, the leaders in resveratrol science, Medicare is a new pelleted daily supplement offering metabolic support for easy keepers. Medicare was formulated by Pat Lawless, PhD, to support optimum carbohydrate and fat metabolism, healthy body weight, and appropriate insulin levels in horses, thanks to a proprietary combination of resveratrol, flavonoids, and amino acids. Learn more at www.equithrive.com. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you navigate making purchasing recommendations when you find things on the exam, especially when you're in this more condensed setting and everything has to be done so quickly. How do you manage that, and how do you handle any like conflicts of interest or anything that might potentially come up?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, we have to be very organized when we're doing this because, you know, in fairness to the people that are trying to buy horses, they have a lot of conversations on their end. And sometimes they're agents and they're working for the buyer who ultimately will pay for the horse. So they're having a lot of conversations, and some of it is last minute. And so typically, if I can get a short list, even the night before we start the next day's selling session, if I'm able to at least read the radiographs that night, and the video scope, if it's available, I've got potentially two of the three elements of my job taken care of the night before so that I can get out into the shed row early with my assistant and go and do the physical exams on a relatively efficient basis like that. So if, of course, there are horses added on all the time, so it feels rather hectic. You know, you try to be as organized as possible, but people are adding horses. And then, of course, you've got to report the findings on a timely basis. So it's a little bit like the equine equivalent of air traffic control.
Yeah.
And as far as you had touched on this, but as far as what the job is it is a risk assessment. It'd be very rare. People like to use the words pass or fail in the veterinary exam, and I don't ever pass and I don't ever fail a horse. I'm just providing information, and the reason that's an important point is because you may have one horse that's appropriate for one of your clients and not appropriate for another client, same horse, just simply because they have different levels of risk tolerance and different potential usages. Just to give you a great example, if there was a race filly and the horses of racing age sale, and one client is just interested in racing and they want to race now, and the other client is mostly interested in a potential breeding career for the filly, and if she has a little issue, maybe they can give her some time and wait. That's completely suitable for one client and completely unsuitable for another client, the same horse. So basically the job is like being a portfolio manager, where you're assessing risk based on the physical exam, the radiographs, and the scope. And then you're presenting that risk to your client, and hopefully you know your client well enough to know what their level of risk tolerance is and what their intentions are. And that's where good communication comes in between the vet and the client.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I imagine you get a lot more proficient at working in this sort of environment and making these quick assessments as the more that you do this. It's a little bit different from how typical pre-purchase exams would be run.
Well, and there's always room for conversation. You know, some of the stuff is pretty straightforward. And with the way we've kind of evolved to texting a lot of the results to clients, which they prefer because then they can refer back to it easily. And I try to condense or abbreviate the findings so that it's very simple, you know. And if there's ever a point of discussion, I say, please call me. We should discuss this. And then we can have a full discussion if necessary. But that's usually the exception and not the rule.
Right. Do you ever find anything very unexpected when you're doing exams? Or are you ever in a position where you find a horse that maybe needs to retire from racing and unexpectedly, or have to navigate any challenging situations like that? Or is that more of a rare occurrence?
Yeah, I mean, when I say unexpected, I tend more to thinking about in terms of what's uncommon. And occasionally, it doesn't even happen at every sale, but every once in a while, strangely, a horse will be presented at a sale that is a little bit suspicious. I'm suspicious that it may have a mild neurologic signs. And a lot of times, I mean, some of these horses can run and some can run reasonably well, with some very, very mild neuroscience, but it's something that I always pay attention to at sales, because it really then requires a lot of discussion with the potential buyer. And it doesn't even necessarily mean that they won't buy the horse. I had one instance that was kind of a learning experience for me, where it was a young horse. It was either a weanling or a short yearling, either a November or January sale. And the client asked me to look at an RNA, which is a horse that didn't sell, reserve not attained. And it was a filly, and she was obviously neurologic. And I said, well, you know, I thought that would be the end for her. And she said, well, she actually said to me, I love her. So that meant she was going to buy her, and she did. And with instructions from me to reduce the nutritional plane of the horse significantly, to slow the growth rate down. And she took the horse back to Florida, did exactly that. And this filly turned out to be one of the best fillies in the country as a racehorse. And so there was a big learning experience for me as to what you can and can't do. But that would be the exception rather than the rule. Most of the time, if they're neurologic, that's a very significant risk, not just from a performance standpoint, but from a liability standpoint as well.
Right. How is some of the new technology that's becoming available shaping your work? Has that really impacted the auction space at all? I know that there are advances in imaging technology, and then biometric sensors are becoming more widespread in the thoroughbred world. So have you noticed any sort of impact of these?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say, I mean, I think the biometric sensors are a really incredible and important advance, but they don't really impact our sales world too much, because those are horses that are really, by that point, are racing. And when they retire from racing, that information isn't really very, it wouldn't be pertinent so much to a purchase exam, because at that point, the horses are being purchased to do something else. But one of the advances in technology that has helped me personally is advanced imaging called PET scanning. And I think that's been in the news quite a bit. And sometimes it's used, especially in some of the more prominent races, in terms of if a horse comes into question as far as its soundness, that imaging may help to determine the horse's suitability for racing on that day. And so that has actually helped me in a few purchase exams. I've done some private exams of horses at the racetrack that had some radiographic findings, but they weren't so pronounced as to be boosted into a high-risk territory. And so in order to be able to sort out how those findings were affecting the horse right now, we went ahead and PET scanned some of these horses. And when they PET scan negative, meaning that those findings on the radiographs do not appear to be clinically active, it's a level of assurance that helps the client to make their decision. So yes, I've used that, and I think that it's been really helpful to me.
That's great. That's probably a lot more applicable in private sale than auction. I would imagine you wouldn't have the opportunity to dig in at that environment.
Yeah, it's the auction is a whole different world, because we try to stay organized in a very chaotic environment, and there's just never enough time. There would never be enough time to, you know, go and PET scan a horse at a public auction. And, you know, it might be appropriate in a horses of racing age sale if you had the time, but typically we don't. So,
right. Yeah, that makes sense. What about some of the objective gait analysis technologies? Have those ever come up in discussion? Is anyone using those in the thoroughbred space?
Not in the sales. I mean, at a private sale, you could pretty much do anything you want. And if you wanted to apply that technology, I think that you could. But typically, and you know, I mean, when you think about it, we're being asked, nobody wants you to go a distance, fly somewhere to examine one horse that's a mediocre horse. These are usually very high-end horses,
right?
Grade one winners that have just come out of grade one events. And so, you know, if they jump through all the normal hoops, there would have to be something that flags that horse to make you want to go to any kind of advanced imaging or advanced lameness detection devices.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So I'd like to talk now about some of the ethical challenges you potentially face in the sales environment, and also how social license to operate is potentially impacting this field of work.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, my ethical challenges, I think, are reduced because I'm working primarily for buyers. I think the challenge is for veterinarians. It's more of a challenge for veterinarians that are working for sellers because, you know, selling horses is a very complicated business in the sense that things happen. Horses injure themselves, you know, all kinds of things happen. And so there's a temptation for people sometimes to want to blur the lines a little bit in order to help get a horse sold. And fortunately, I don't find myself in that position because I'm working mostly for buyers. And the sellers that I do work for, I have about 3 clients in the Lexington area that I do consulting work for. And they're all completely honest and above board, and I've never been asked by them. Now, I know that not everybody is so honest, but I'm fortunate not to work for those. So, and by design, you know, I think that everybody's ethics is determined by themselves, you know, by their own ethical stance. And so if somebody asks you to do something unethical, you can always say no. Now, you may lose a client, but maybe that's not the client that you want to have anyway. So that's a personal choice. But no, for me, doing sales work, there's really ethical issues involved.
Yeah, that's great. Have you noticed any impact of some of like the media criticisms of the racing industry in your field of work, or has that not really impacted the sales environment?
I think the industry functions as, you know, my little corner of the world as doing thoroughbred sales work is a part of the whole. So it's very much impacted by the general perception of racing and breeding and all the things that go along with that. So, I mean, I've been very involved. There's an initiative called Light Up Racing. I don't know if you've heard of it, but
yeah,
it's basically essentially designed to be media training and a social media based way of correcting the false narratives about thoroughbred racing. And so I'd encourage all of your listeners to go to the website and just look around. There are a lot of questions that are commonly asked about racing that are answered on the website. And there's also opportunities for media training and being parts of social media groups to try to basically correct all of the inaccurate information that seems to be out there. But I do think that it impacts the sales world to the degree that we're a part of the larger whole of racing and breeding in North America.
Right. Yeah, it's such an extensive industry with so many different corners, lots of people involved. So as we wrap up today, do you have anything else that you'd like to add about your work or any advice for veterinarians who might be interested in becoming involved?
Well, I think it's fascinating and I like the travel. I like going from place to place. I think that I'd encourage any veterinarian that was interested in doing and pursuing it. But I think it's not a short road, it's a long road in the sense that I think that it requires a few things. It requires a lot of experience in lameness diagnosis. It also requires, I think, an understanding that we're not passing and failing horses, that we are giving information to help our individual clients to achieve their goals. And so it's not quite as simple as just a pass or a fail thing. And you know, per your question about, you know, the ethical issues, I think it's just important to determine right from the beginning that you're going to have the appropriate ethical stance, that you're going to do the right thing and say the right things and comport yourself well in the shed row and just be prepared to work very hard.
Awesome. Well, that's great advice. And I really appreciate having you on this episode to shed a little bit more light onto this path of veterinary medicine.
Sure, happy to do it.
Awesome. I'd like to say thank you again to Dr. Berg for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode of Disease du Jour. And as always, thank you to our audience for listening. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.